Going to start on time this evening. First of all, thank you everyone who came in the cold to learn tonight, and a special thanks to Rabbi Sabolofsky, who came from the furthest distance, I would imagine, to come teach us Torah this evening. Rabbi Sabolofsky, for those who, first of all, before I forget, I want to thank tonight's sponsors, the Sherman family, as well as the Apfel family. We thank you very much for your sponsorship and the zechus of the Talmud Torah of the Tzibur this evening. Should be a zechus for your families, and you should always be zochet to support Torah in our community and in all of Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Sabolofsky, if you don't know him, it's very hard to encapsulate in a sentence or two, and certainly he wouldn't allow me to do more than a sentence or two, but I have to say I was very taken. I don't know, who wrote this bio? Is this?
I think it's from the website.
Yes, I was very taken by this one line in the bio. I don't know if you... It says, after it goes through Rabbi Sabolofsky's popularity in yeshiva, it says, some credit this popularity to his ability to blend the teaching styles of his two teachers, Rabbi Mordechai Willig and Rabbi Herschel Schechter. Rabbi Willig is known for his focus toward practical understanding, and Rabbi Schechter is known for his ability to present topics in the Talmud in a broader context. Rabbi Sabolofsky blends these two styles to form a unique package that many students find most rewarding. That's fantastic. that is a really, really excellent description. I always thought if Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Willig were to get together and like create a Talmud, that would represent the very best of both of them. Well, they sort of have, and for that we have Rabbi Sabolofsky, and it's a very great kavod for our community to be able to hear any divrei Torah from Rabbi Sabolofsky, certainly on such a pertinent topic, halacha lemaisa, that of Hilchas Nida. We thank him again very much for coming and look forward to his share this evening.
Well, yeah, I can tell you, I did not write that line. Rishus HaRav. So it's a little bit of a daunting task here, because I was told to have about 45 minutes to an hour to try to sum up all of Hilchos Nida. So we're not going to be able to, I tell you, with Chilim, we're not going to be able to do that. But what we're going to try to do is try to highlight some of the, in a sense, Rashi Brachim, some of the more... I don't know if we want to use the word interesting. Hopefully all of halach is interesting. Some of the more pertinent, some of the more relevant, some of the more perhaps controversial issues that are raised in Hilchos Nida, particularly Bizman HaZeh. Try to get just a little bit of a feel as to how Rabbanim try to deal with these particular shailas. I'm not necessarily going to give absolute hardcore halach lemais conclusions. Probably by the way I present things, you may get a sense as to which way I'm leaning. But I'll leave it up to the Marat Asriel. He's very, very qualified in his own right to be able to pass in the Maisa for people. But we'll try to at least try to give a little bit of exposure to what some of these important, critical, and again, sometimes controversial issues in Hilchos Nida are Bizman HaZeh. So the first issue that I want to tackle is based on a Gemara Maseches Nida, where the Gemara tells us almost what we would call the ABCs of Hilchos Nida, that there is a difference in Hilchos Nida whether we're dealing with the Nida D'Araisa or we're dealing with Nida Midrabanan. Obviously, the parish of Nida, of course, is a din min HaTorah, but not every time a woman experiences bleeding does she automatically become a Nida on the level of D'Araisa. What is necessary to enter into that state of Nida's D'Araisa is what is called Hargosha, very, very roughly defined as some kind of a sensation. We'll define it a little bit more as we go on. But a bleeding that is accompanied by some type of a physical sensation is what creates the status of Nida's D'Araisa. If there is bleeding from that area, from uterine bleeding, it's the same biological blood, but it is lacking that physical sensation, whatever that's defined to mean, then we are not, by definition, we are not dealing with Nida's D'Araisa. I didn't say that it's permissible. What we are dealing with is what's called Hilchos Nida Midrabanan, or we usually call it Ksamim, literally translated to mean stains. So if a woman finds a stain out of the context of a halachic hargosha, she is still potentially asura, but since it's only midrabanan, there are many, many important kulas, very relevant kulas bizman hazeh, that the halachas of ksam midrabanan are subject to. So we have to always be careful whenever we're passing a shayla Hilchos Nida, are we dealing with a deraisa dika shayla, or are we dealing with a derabanan dika shayla? If we're dealing with a deraisa dika shayla, which means riyas dam plus hargosha, then there's very, very little leeway for any kinds of kulas. Once we enter into the realm of only, I say that, you know, a little bit of hesitation, but only Nida Derabanan, then we have a whole series of kulas. Just to familiarize ourselves for a moment, what are some of the potential kulas that we're dealing with if we're only dealing with Nida Derabanan? If a woman finds a stain, she finds a kesem. So Chazal tell us that this prohibition of ksamim, the Nida Derabanan of ksamim, was only instituted if the kesem is a certain size. If it's a very, very small kesem, then we could just absolutely ignore it. what right do we have to ignore it if we're pretty confident we know exactly where it's coming from? So the Mishnah and the Gemara Maseches Nida explained to us that we can assume, or at least in the olden days assume, that, well, it's probably not even coming from the woman anyway. It's possibly coming from another source. Maybe it's coming from a bug. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of the bed bugs that Chazal is describing, very gory sugars in the end of Maseches Nida. But if it's a very small amount, the size of a gris, less than the size of a gris, which is approximately the size of a U.S. penny, so if it's a very small kesem, we could just close our eyes and say, forget about it, doesn't matter, doesn't interest us, and she becomes muteris. That type of a kula would only exist because we're dealing with nida derabanan. Another important kula is that if the kesem shows up on something which is colored, then we can ignore it also. As we're all familiar with, color plays a major role in hilchos nida, and if something shows up on a colored garment or some other kind of colored item, then it's very hard to discern precisely what the color was. So Chazal said, forget about it, it's all right. It's only derabanan anyway. It's what we call tzivonim. Everything's fine. A third kula, if a kesem shows up on a davar she'eino makabel tuma, if it's something that's not susceptible to the halachas of tuma v'tahara, then it's only derabanan anyway. We can ignore that as well. Just in case you wanted to know what is makabel tuma, what's not makabel tuma, so you can take a look at the Shach in Hilchos Nida, where the Shach says, no big deal, just take a look at the Mishnayos of Maseches Kelim and you'll figure it out on your own. 30 prakim of Mishnayos, that unless you were learning this for somebody Shloshim, the odds are you probably haven't learned it recently, and if you were learning for Shloshim, the odds are you didn't understand this, don't feel bad, because since today's the Shach, not too many people have understood it. Just quickly, a reference point, some of the important things that Bezman HaZeh are most probably not makabel tuma, at least according to many opinions, toilet paper, tissue paper, at least according to the view of Rav Moshe Feinstein, is not makabel tuma. That's a very, very big kula. A pad or anything similar to that which is disposable is probably not makabel tuma, according to many opinions. A toilet bowl is not makabel tuma because it's mechuba lekarka, it's connected to the ground. Unless you get the unlucky shayla, like I did one time get, where somebody actually called me about a shayla kesem on a toilet bowl, and after discussing it for a moment, I realized that they were calling me from the plane. It was the only toilet bowl that exists that's not mechuba lekarka, and the shayla changed radically. So, but putting that aside, many things that we have today, many stains do show up on things that are either in a makabel tuma, or they're colored, the woman is wearing colored undergarments, or very often the ksamim that show up are very, very small ksamim. So as long as we're not dealing with a nida deraisa, we can ignore all of the above. If we're dealing with nida deraisa, then all bets are off. So the question becomes, well, how do we make that call? How do we make that determination whether there was hargasha or not? So there are different opinions in the poskim already, in old machlokas back in the days of the Rishonim. What precisely is the hargasha? There's some Rishonim who describe Hagosha as being some kind of a trembling, a sensation, or something that the woman feels that may or may not accompany the actual period. Sometimes some poskim describe what we call Ziva's Darvalach, that she feels a little bit of moisture, which comes very, very, very precise question where exactly she's experiencing this flow, this moisture. There are perhaps other kinds of Hagoshas that are described. When all the dust settles, it's very hard to get an absolute answer what Hagosha is and what Hagosha is not. Which leads us almost to a little bit of a question, are we really dealing with nida deraisa, nida derabanan, in any given shayla that comes our way? So there are two different approaches in the poskim as to what the criteria we should use. Sometimes if we ask the woman, well, did you feel, it's hard for her to answer. Even if we pose the question, did you feel what we call a zivas davalach, well, I did, but maybe it was external, but it was internal. It's always very, very ambiguous whether we've officially reached the point of our gosh that the poskim are describing. So usually two different criteria are used by poskim today. One criteria is volume. It's a significant amount of blood. If a woman comes and she tells you that I had so much bleeding that I had to put on a pad and it was all over the place, but it happened to be that all the blood was on enema kabel tuma. All the blood was on tzivon and was uncolored. It's very hard to be makel on that. That most probably a significant volume of blood is, we assume, is accompanied by a hargosha. So even if we can't put our finger on that hargosha, we assume that halachically it is hargosha, and therefore we're dealing with the nida deraisa, and all the kulas are not going to apply. Another very important and somewhat of a controversial criteria that some poskim use is, what if we strongly suspect that this is her period? Now, it could be her period without necessarily being a significant amount of blood. Many women are on different kinds of medications, and very often different kinds of pills, which are beyond the scope right now, whether if and when the women should be on the pills for other reasons, but assuming a woman is on a pill in a justified manner, And now she has something that mimics a period. A very, very small amount of blood, but it seems to fit into, pattern-wise, where she's expecting to have a quote-unquote period. Can we close our eyes and say, well, it's just a minuscule amount, and it was on color, and it was on toilet paper, and we're just going to ignore it? So many poskim are very concerned with that. Many poskim are concerned that if this is what we call an halacha derech re'iyasa, this is harm, period. She's on medication X, Y, and Z, that now is, in a sense, playing games with our cycle, that our periods are not the way they were in the past. If this is her cycle, it's very hard to close her eyes and say, well, it's only the Rabbanan, and therefore we have Kula X, Y, and Z. So the bottom line is that when a Shaila is presented, so it's not an absolute to say, well, it's on cold, and it's all right. Somebody was telling me a story about a woman who apparently had gone to one of the chas, Nida Shirim, but hadn't gone to part two, and she didn't quite understand the difference between Nida Derais and Ksamim, and she was under the impression that as long as she's wearing color during those days when she gets her period, she's fine. So she was getting full-fledged periods on color, and assuming that she was Muteres. So I have to disagree with that. I would say that she was a Asura, probably to the extent of an Issachar. So a very, very serious mistake in Hilchos Nida. So one has to be careful that these kulas are important, and any time a Shaila is presented to a Rav, so it should be presented, should be clear, are we dealing with something which is a Chashash of Hargosha? Is it something which is only Ksamim? And again, the Rav will ask accordingly, using different criteria to determine which area of Hilchos Nida we're in. So that's the first important issue that has to be clarified in Hilchos Nida. The second issue I want to speak about, also a very common type of a Shaila, is a woman will sometimes experience bleeding, or we will suspect that she may be experiencing bleeding, even though it's not a regular period, and it may not even be, in a sense, a regular kesem. She may have gone for some kind of a procedure, some kind of a gynecological procedure, which sometimes can literally cause bleeding, and sometimes could potentially cause us to be concerned that there is bleeding there. And how do we deal with this type of blood? So there is a principle that appears in the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch called Dam Makah. The Gemara says explicitly that if a woman has a wound, if she has bleeding coming from some type of a wound, that technically does not make her into a Nida. What is unclear is exactly where this wound is situated and exactly what the source of this bleeding, of this quote-unquote wound, is all about. The Gemara has a whole discussion. We showed him a very, very detailed discussion about how do we find out this information? How in the world are we going to know whether she has a wound or she doesn't have a wound? So much of that discussion in the Rishonim, in the Shulchan Aruch, how to figure out the facts, has been alleviated bizman hazeh, because simply she goes to the doctor. The doctor takes a look and sees. I'm telling you, we don't have to pilpul with fakers and maislach and kunzim to try to figure out where the blood is probably coming from. You take a look with the proper instrument, and you can see exactly where the blood is coming from. The question is then, therefore what? So now that we've ascertained, modern medicine has told us exactly where the blood is coming from, just parenthetically, we do take the word of a doctor in this area, even though the Rishonim did discuss about whether a doctor has ne'amanus altogether to say that the woman is bleeding from a makah. It's generally assumed by the poskim today that the doctors, both Jewish and non-Jewish, have ne'amanus for a variety of reasons. One reason is that doctors today, when they make a statement about Hilchos Nida, they're not philosophizing and saying, well, we think it would appear to us that you're probably bleeding from a makah. They're actually looking, they're seeing. And if the doctor's telling us something that's not true, she can go to another doctor who will catch up, run it right away. That's why it is important that even though we do give a significant amount of credibility to doctors today, that's only assuming that the doctor actually examines the woman. Sometimes you have a situation where a woman will call the doctor and describe certain symptoms, and the doctor will say, no problem, you have a makah. And the woman will call the rabbi back and say, everything's great, the doctor said that I have a makah. Which I will ask, did the doctor examine you? No, the doctor said, don't even bother coming in, I'm telling you it's a makah. The doctor may be right, he may not be right, but he doesn't have ne'amanus just to philosophize about a makah. If he has re'ias a makah, that's a different story. But what exactly does that mean, that the doctor is telling us that there is that makah here? So if the doctor is telling us that the makah is not from the uterus, that's, in a sense, the best case scenario for Hilchos Nida, because only blood from the uterus is considered to be dam nidus. So the doctor examines the woman and sees that the blood is coming from totally externally, from the vaginal area, so that's wonderful in terms of Hilchos Nida. If the doctor examines her a little bit further and sees the blood is coming from the cervix, so that's also okay in terms of Hilchos Nida. There are many procedures that are done that actually will cause bleeding of the cervix. A very common shaila is a woman goes for a pap smear, and in the process of the pap smear, so they remove a little bit from the cervix, and very often will cause bleeding. So the poskim assume that's not considered to be dam nidus. That's dam makah. What gets a little bit trickier in halacha is when the doctor goes further in and certain procedures are done, or not necessarily procedures are done, sometimes she has her own issue, that there's bleeding from a quote-unquote makla, but the makla is very much inside the uterus. It's actual endometrial lining bleeding, so we know exactly where it's coming from. We even caused the makla. We did some procedure. We did something like, just for argument's sake, an endometrial biopsy. So we scraped a little bit of the lining away, so we know exactly where the source of the bleeding is. Is that considered to be that makla or not? That's a big machlekes apelskim. There are some poskim who say that any blood, even from the uterus, that came about through some kind of a medical scraping, an incision, anything of that nature, is automatically considered to be damaka and nothing to be concerned with. And other poskim were a little bit more weary to make that statement. Other poskim were of the opinion that if she's getting some kind of a cervical bleeding, that we can make a lot. Vaginal bleeding, we can make a lot. If it's uterine bleeding, so even though it was caused by us through an instrument, not so simple that that's not considered to be a problem of hilchos nida. What makes these shilas even more complicated is that many of these procedures, the source of bleeding is from multiple sources. Sometimes it can be cervical bleeding as well as uterine bleeding, and it's a very hard call to say where exactly this particular bleeding is coming from. Any of these kinds of shilas really must be evaluated properly by a rav together with the doctor to make sure that we're getting all the facts, like all the areas of halacha. The most important part of answering a shilas is to make sure you have the facts straight. And then after we get the facts straight from the medical personnel, then the rav will try to make that assessment. Is this cervical blood halachli? Is it uterine blood halachli? If it's uterine blood, are we going to be mach? Are we going to be mekel? Some of the things that we spoke about at the beginning are going to impact on this as well. Sometimes the question may be, are we really dealing with a kesem? Are we dealing with something more serious? If we're dealing with a very, very small stain, so that we may be more willing to almost look the other way, because it's only durabanan anyway, and it's a shaila, a certain sphakis, maybe we'll be willing to be more lenient about a durabanan dicker question. If you're dealing with a more significant amount of blood, then the shaila is going to become a more significant shaila. There is another issue that comes up whenever we deal with a woman going for a medical procedure. What the Gemara tells us in Maseches Nida is that yevshel psichas hakever b'loy dam. Any time strangely Chazal described the rechem, the uterus, as the kever, there's a lot of hashkafa behind that, but not for now. That any time the uterus is opened up, so then we automatically assume there must have been some blood there. So here you can have a situation where a woman becomes a nida, potentially, even though she didn't bleed. I mean, she didn't bleed to our eyes visibly, but there was halachically a concern of psichas hamakor. So this is a question that the poskim raise anytime a woman goes for any kinds of a procedure. Are we running into this potential pitfall of psichas hamakor, which will automatically render the woman a nida, even in the absence of blood? So the answer is that most of the time, not. Most of the time, most of the procedures that are done today don't enter into this problem for a variety of reasons. The issue of psichas hamakor is only if you actually went into the makor, which is the whole question exactly where the makor begins. There is a halachic / medical area of somewhat ambiguity, the area of the cervix, whether that's considered halachically the makor for these purposes. If you take the approach, if you take the more lenient approach, that psichas hamakor, that renders uchas nida, is only when an instrument would enter into the actual uterus, so that would make us ignore any cervical procedure, automatically could be ignored. Any uterine procedure may become problematic, but the post can point out, based on the Gemara's and Maseches Nida, that psichas hamakor only exists when there's a significant opening. A very, very minuscule opening is not considered to be a problem. And most of the procedures that are done today, perhaps not all of them, the opening is very, very small. For medical purposes, they're not going to make a very large opening. It's going to be a very, very small width of an instrument. And more likely than not, it's going to fall short in terms of causing a problem. So most of the shilas that we have today in terms of medical procedures are not issues of psichas hamakor, according to many opinions. There are issues of bleeding. If the woman is bleeding, then we have to figure out, is it makor, not makor? So the shayla is a very real bisman is there. But this approach of gavalt, she went to the doctor, now she's automatically a nida to prove it otherwise, is usually not the case. So it's important to know, when a woman goes to the doctor, find out exactly what she's going for, be able to describe the process, you know, to the rav, and hopefully be able to put their heads together with the doctors to figure out whether the woman became a nida or did not become a nida. There is a related issue to psichas hamakor. This is already an old issue that the post can discuss. It's still very relevant to today. And that's in terms of childbirth. At what point in the process of childbirth does a woman become a nida? So the the issue that we raised is psichas ha-mokor. When the uterus begins to open up, so then she automatically, by default, becomes a nida. So is that true in the case of childbirth? So that's very, very tricky, because we know, obviously, the area opens up, otherwise the baby's not going to come out. But at what point do we say that she's reached that point of sufficiently opening up that we have to be concerned maybe she's a nida, even though she hasn't technically seen anything yet? So they asked her, Moshe Feinstein, this Shaila. They asked her, Moshe, said, at the very beginning of the ninth month, it's very common, a woman goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, great, you're 1 centimeter dilated already. So if she's giving birth for the first time, she's so excited. Why? Because she figures, well, I'm a tenth of the way there already, and it didn't hurt at all. Little does she know that the pain of the next nine are significantly more than the first one. So Rav Moshe says that, obviously, whatever she's experiencing at the very beginning of the ninth month, that she's dilated a little bit, that's obviously not the psichas ha-mokar that Chazal was describing. It must be some later point. What is the later point? Very unclear what the later point is. The Gemara has a discussion about psichas ha-mokar, different ways of measuring psichas ha-mokar, not in terms of the area itself, but different symptoms that a woman may be having that may indicate to us that she may have a psichas ha-mokar. The Gemara talks in a little bit of a different context about if a woman is having difficulty walking, maybe that's indicative that she's opening up already sufficiently, she's experiencing a psichas ha-mokar. That becomes very, very hard for us to judge bisman hazeh, because very often women at that point, they're in the hospital already and they're already hooked up to an epidural and she may not be walking anyway. So it's sometimes hard to put into modern terms what exactly are some of these equivalents in the poskim. There are many opinions in the poskim who say that we don't have to be concerned with this, and as long as the woman hasn't actively bleeding yet, if she's literally bleeding, or if her water breaks, and very often there's blood in the water, if there's real Re'ias Dam, then we have to be concerned. If there's some of these like very, very early contractions and early labor, and even though sometimes the very, very early labor, even pre-contractions, is accompanied by a little bit of cervical bleeding, the mucus breaking apart, so that's usually not considered to be such a serious problem. So again, there are different opinions in the poskim where exactly you draw the line, at what point a woman in childbirth becomes a nida. There are many opinions who are lenient that until she's really, really starting to actively bleed, she's not considered to be a nida. Why is this so important? Obviously, at this point in the game, the couple are not being literally together. But this is important in terms of harchakos. It's important in terms of physical contact. It's important in terms of the husband watching and seeing. One of the halachas of harchakos, one of the things that a couple are not permitted to do when she is a nida, is that he's not allowed to look at what we call mekomos hamechusos, those parts of the body that are generally covered. So obviously, if the husband is going to be there in the delivery room, if he's going to be looking directly at that area, so even if he's not literally mamash osa makom, but even if he's going to be looking at part of her body that is uncovered, so that would not be permissible if she's already a nida. So it's important for us to know, at what point can he still hold her hand, at what point can he not? So it's important to know, to demarcate exactly when she becomes a nida. There are different opinions. There are some poskim who put it at a much earlier stage in delivery, and others who put it a little bit later. Again, to defer to your particular Rav in terms of where exactly the line of demarcation is in terms of this procedure. So we spoke a little bit about how the woman becomes a nida, how she becomes a nida deraisa, how she becomes a nida derabanan, a little bit of just literally the Rashi Prakim of some of the gynecological examinations, childbirth, etc. Now that the woman has already become a nida, the next goal is to try to get her out of the stage of being a nida. So how do we do that? So here we know the halacha tells us that every time a woman has been paskin that she is asura, the only way she can become uteris is that multiple things have to happen. She has to count shivanikiyim under all circumstances. She has to count 7 complete full days. And then, of course, she has to go to the mikvah. So let's try to see if we can just walk through a little bit some of the more common shailos that come up in the process of the woman attempting to become tahora. So in order for a woman to become tahora, we said she has to count shivanikiyim. The Mishnah tells us in the end of Maseches Nida that how in the world would you ever know that she is nakia? How would you ever know that she has stopped bleeding? So the answer is, well, she has to check herself. And that's what we call in halacha a hefsek tahara. Even though the Mishnah, strangely enough, uses the phrase a hafrasha b'tahara, somewhere between the days of the Mishnah and today, that term switched. I haven't yet pinpointed historically when that switch was. It means the exact same thing. Either hafrasha b'tahara or hafsaka b'tahara, hefsek tahara, which is the term that's generally used today. So a woman has to do what's called hefsek tahara before the beginning of the 7 clean days. If she didn't check herself beforehand, then she has no way of knowing that she's not still bleeding. So it's absolutely critical that a woman check herself in a halakhically acceptable manner before the beginning of the 7 clean days. Since yomim in halacha, days begin at night, and since the halacha tells us that once the sun sets, that's already a suffik yom, suffik laila, it is obvious, or at least it should be obvious, that a hefsek tara must precede the beginning of the halachic day, or the beginning of the suffik halachic day, which translates to mean, let's say if shkia today was approximately 5:30, if a woman wanted to make a hefsek tara today, if she wants to count the first of our Shivanakiyam starting tomorrow, so she has to have done a bedika, she has to have checked herself internally, done a hefsek tara sometime before 5:30 today. Now, very often that's not the case. Very often a woman forgot. All of a sudden she wakes up, Baruch, here I am at 5:40, and I forgot to do a hefsek tara. Is there any way to salvage that? So this is part of a general approach to life. Namely, are you a type of person who davens mincha after shkia? Do you eat shalosh shudas after shkia? What's your general take on the sun setting? So there are different approaches in Klal Yisrael about that. Some people believe that the sun sets when it sets, and other people somehow think it's still hanging around the sky for a while, hasn't quite set. Maybe depending on which borough of New York City you live in, and I don't want to make too many comments about that. Suffice it to say that at least the tradition that I was raised in is that the sun sets when it sets. Somebody told me once that they asked Nevinson, so in Yerushalayim, Shkia is like the sun sets when it sets, not a second later. So somebody told me they once asked Nevinson what he thought about a Hefsek Tara like 30 seconds after Shkia. So the person who told me the story said that Rav Nevinson looked at the person like they had landed from the moon. That he said to him, Zachar Hashkia. But the person said, but it's only 30 seconds. But Zachar Hashkia, Shkia is over. What was the latest of Suffolk? But there are certain Rabbanim in certain communities that are a little bit more lenient about this. Again, I don't want to take any stand on anything, but again, the Rabbanim I've learned from, so we generally follow the view that Shkia, that's sacred, and if it's after Shkia, then you have to push it off already another day. So therefore, it's important for a woman to get into the practice of when she wants to do Hefsek Tara, to make sure to do it, not at the last second, but to play it safe, do it a little bit earlier. How much earlier is earlier? So the Shulchan Aruch tells us that we don't really recommend a woman to do Hefsek Tara very, very early in the day, because if she does it very early, so then, how do you know, maybe she started to bleed again. The goal of the Hefsek Tara is to prove to us that the bleeding is stopped, and she gets the process of Shivanakiyam, to begin. So we really want to get it late in the day, but we don't want to get it by the buzzer at Shkia. So we try to aim for it a little bit late in the afternoon, but not too late. What I usually like to tell women to do is, if all else is equal, she try to do Hefsek Tara about a half hour before Shkia. That gives her a little bit of a leeway on two grounds. Number one, if she gets a phone call, she gets stuck, she gets lost, something happens, so she has a couple of minutes to play with. And number two, very often the Hefsek Tara is not good. Very often there's a shayla on the Hefsek Tara. Very often it's obvious it's no good. Very often it's a questionable Hefsek Tara, and she wants to chop another Hefsek Tara. So there becomes a very big question in the postgame about, can you almost like play a game, do multiple Hefsek Taras. So she'll do one now, it's a little bit of red, do another one, a little less red, do another. By the time you do 15 of them, there's nothing else left. So the Chazon Ish was not a big fan of those types of Hefsek Taras. He thought you have to give a little bit of a realistic chance for the second Hefsek Tara to almost to register immediately after the first Hefsek Tara. How much time you have to give to register is unclear. The Chazon Ish doesn't give you a number on the clock. Different Rabbanim have different numbers about this. But suffice it to say, if a woman starts a half hour before Shkia, so she has enough time to either to repeat, perhaps even to repeat more than once, so she has a couple of minutes to play with. If you go down to the wire and you first start at 2 minutes before Shkia, number one, your clock may be off. I've been multiple times, women have called me, say, "Hey, Gavalt, I realized I thought it was a minute before Shkia, the bathroom clock said this, and my cell phone said that, and my husband's phone said yadam, and this radio station said it's this, and this atomic clock said it's another one. You want me to be machriya? I should decide who has the right time." So, and who says that it's bottom of the calendar to the millisecond? So one has to be a little bit careful of this to try to give yourself a little bit of a window in terms of not doing it too early. On the other hand, not doing it too late either. Some rabbanim recommend that since the halacha does say that a hefsek tara done even early in the day is b'diavad acceptable, so there are rabbanim who recommend that women, especially today, many of our wives work. They have a very busy schedule, and sometimes she's stuck in an office at, it's 5:25 and she queues in 2 minutes and she can't run out of a meeting. So that would be really, it would be chaval to lose an entire day because of that. So many rabbanim recommend, let her do Hefsek Tara in the morning as a backup. So So that way she knows before she goes out to work, the Hefsek Torah is done and completed. L'chatchila, we should have the Hefsek Torah late in the afternoon. If she remembers late, if she's able to, she should do another one later, a few minutes before Shkia. But at least, if all said and done, she always has the backup Hefsek Torah. That's not a bad habit to get into. If a woman's able to do that, that way she'll always know that b'di'ev, if she can't do it later, she could still rely on the previous Hefsek Torah. So a woman does Hefsek Torah, and assuming that everything is okay, then there is a practice that appears in the Rishonim, it has its roots in the Mishnah a little bit, but the way it's practiced today is more of a minhag than a din, is that what we call a moch, that after a woman does Hefsek Torah, so right before Shkia, she takes another bedikta cloth and inserts it in that area and leaves it there until Tzeisik Echav, until the stars come out. That's almost like a super duper mahadrim and a mahadrim Hefsek Torah. Hefsek Torah just means she went around a little bit, inside and shined. A moch means it was there for a significant amount of time. So that's the lechatchila of how to do a Hefsek Torah. First you do a regular Hefsek Torah, and then you follow that with a moch. The moch is not me'ikra din most of the time, and therefore, depending on different circumstances, different rabbanim will waive the requirement of a moch. Very often, if a woman has irritations in that area, there'll be more grounds to be making on a moch. So again, a rav should be consulted. A woman or a husband should not take the attitude, well, I remember moch is not really so important anyway, so we'll just throw out the window. It's an age-old custom. There's a reason for it, and sometimes it's more important than others. And therefore, a woman should get guidance from the Rav as to when one can forego the moch. But there are certain real circumstances where a moch can, in fact, be avoided. But again, it should be taken almost case-by-case basis. So a woman does her Hefsek Torah, she does her moch. Usually, the Shiva Nikiyam cannot begin until a minimum of 5 days have passed since she began to bleed. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about that because it's usually not relevant lahalacha. Most women don't get a Hefsek Torah anyway. Even if they could get one that was clean, it's very unlikely that's going to happen. So a regular period is going to need at least 5 days. So every once in a while, you have a strange situation where the woman is able to get clean earlier. And sometimes there are certain extenuating circumstances where we could perhaps shave off a day off the 5 days, but those are the very, very far in between, very, very uncommon scenarios, so we're going to leave that out for now. Regular standard of chasnid is what we call 5 and 7, which usually is not even 5 and 7, usually 6 and 7, 7 and 7. It's very often more than just 5 and 7, but 5 and 7 is the bare minimum, 5 days until the Hefsek Torah can be attempted, and then the days of Shiva Nikiyam. During the days of Shiva Nikiyam, so a few things are supposed to happen. The woman is supposed to be wearing white. That's a minhag Yisrael that should be observed unless there are certain extenuating circumstances for that. But perhaps more important, are the bedikas that are supposed to be done. But the Mishnah says in Maseches Nida that during Shiva Nikiyam, a woman is supposed to check herself every day of Shiva Nikiyam. There are, under normal circumstances, a woman should be checking herself every day of Shiva Nikiyam. There are sometimes extenuating circumstances where we will permit a little bit less than the standard checking. The Mishnah says that Me'ika Mikra Din, if she did a Bedika on day 1 and on day 7, so Me'ika Din B'di'evet, she could still go to the mikvah. Now I said that B'di'evet, M'chadchila, that's not supposed to be done. But every once in a while we have a situation, what's called the Shasarcha K'di'evedami. Every once in a while, Rav will permit the woman to forego some of the bedikas in the middle. Sometimes women have certain irritations, have certain medical issues, that doing bedikas may cause more bleeding, and that bleeding is going to have to then be assessed as a damakan, damnida. It's going to cause more trouble than solution. So again, case by case, sometimes the rav will permit the woman to cut down on some of the bedikas in the middle. One should not do that on one's own choice. That has to be something to be evaluated properly when we can, in a sense, observe Shiva Nikiyam on a B'di'evit level rather than on a L'chadchila level. If the woman does not do a B'dika on day 1 or day 7, that's a significant problem to the point where there's a very serious question whether she can even go to the mikvah altogether. If a woman did a B'dika, let's say, each of the 7 days, and then she forgot day 7, and she realizes when she gets to the mikvah, so the Shulchan Aruch paskins that we send her home, she goes back the next day, she does the bedikah on day 8, and day 8 in effect became like the equivalent of day 7, then she goes to the mikvah the next night. That's assuming she was doing bedikahs all along. If she was not doing bedikahs all along, she just did one on day 1, and then she skipped because the rabbi told her 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 don't do, and then she forgot on day 7, then we're in a very serious bind. Because according to the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, she has to start all over again. She has to start mamash the entire week over again. This is a very, very delicate question. This could have serious implications in terms of shalom bayis, sometimes in terms of fertility. So if and when these kinds of shahs come up, they have to be brought immediately to the Rav to be able to determine what the status of these missed bedikas was. If for whatever reason a woman has been instructed not to do bedikas in the middle days, she must be absolutely careful to make sure to do that last bedikah. Because if she doesn't do that bedikah on day 7, we're asking for a significant problem in Uchus Nida. So again, under normal circumstances, bedikas are done every day, and we hope and pray everything will go well in terms of the bedikas. If there are shailas on the bedikas, very often there are, or there are shailas on the Hefsek Tara, shailas on the Moch, so they have to be brought to a Rav in order to determine what the status is. Not all colors are problematic in Uchus Nida. Basically, the starting point is red is a problem. We assume that all shades of red are problematic. Actually, Medina de Gemara, only certain shades of red are problematic. Bizman Hazeh, the Gaonim already told us we don't differentiate between different kinds of reds. It's very hard for us to know. So anything that's in the red family, Rabbanim will Aser today, anything that's not red is technically permissible. Where your line of red is, what point do you think red ends and brown starts? At what point do you think red ends and yellow starts? So there is a little bit of a different nuances, different traditions, different Rabbanim. So again, a Rav has to be consulted. Rav Washimush in this area has to be consulted to make that call whether something is actually technically red or not. When looking at a bedikah cloth, one has to look at it with a significant care, because even the smallest amount, even less than the size of a penny is on ksamim, but bedikah cloth, there's no shear, and even the smallest amount of red will be halachically problematic. Very often, you may bring a shayla to the Rav, and the Rav will say, I can't look at it until tomorrow. Well, I can't look until tomorrow, because the light sometimes is not so perfect to look at. Sometimes it's a cloudy day. Sometimes you need the sun to look at it. So you have to have a little bit of patience. Therefore, I always tell the women and the husbands that it's a very bad idea to save all the bedikas till the end. The person will come, you know, they don't want to bother the rabbi, so they don't bring any of the bedikas till day 7. Day 7 they come with 14 bedikah cloths, and the woman's helped to go to the mikvah, and it's cloudy outside, and it's electric light, you can't tell anything. So I just had this mamash last night. Somebody came frantic to me with a shayla on a bedikah cloth, and I was told that it wasn't even someone from my shul, someone else had sent them to me. But the message I got was, the woman's about to go to the mikveh now, and she has this frantic shayla on a bedikah cloth, what does she do? So when the person brought me the shayla, so it was a very close call. And like I was like hemi annoying, looking and trying, you know, it's the seventh day bedikah, that means you're potentially sending a woman to become a surah for another week. And then in the course of the conversation, the husband said to me, I must have asked him, I said, when is this from exactly? So he said, oh, this is from last week. This was the first day's bedikah. First day's bedikah. Then it's also, I said, it was al lashon, but I said that then I wasn't willing to be make alone. I thought it was a very, very close, too close for comfort. If it would have been a seventh day bedikah, I don't know, I wouldn't have been matir it, but maybe I would have waited until the next day to reassess it, maybe to bring it with somebody else. To push it off for one day, I think it was justified. It was too close to comfort to be matir her to go to the mikveh that night. But what should have happened is that shower should have been brought 6 days earlier rather than at the last moment, because now I had to look at it in an electric light, which never really gives you the perfect look altogether. So in terms of the procedure of a woman becoming tahora, so we spoke about the Hefsek Tara, the Moch, the counting of the Shiva Nikiyim. Now, of course, the main part, what's going to make a Torah, is going to the mikveh. So when we speak about going to the mikveh, an important shayla, a very, very common shayla comes up, is exactly when is this going to the mikveh going to take place? Well, we thought we knew the answer, that after the Shiva Nikiyim are over, so that night she's going to the mikveh. That's what's supposed to happen. That a woman is not supposed to go to the mikveh before the culmination entirely of the full Shiva Nikiyim. The Gemara does talk about the possibility of a woman under very unique circumstances perhaps going to the mikveh by yom. So it's not something that we generally like to do. There's a big, big discussion in the poskim as to what are the parameters, if and when, are there any real cases that we could permit a woman to go to the mikveh even on the seventh day mibayom. So this is a very, very localized area of halach in the sense of different rabbanim have different traditions about this. This is, the whole discussion should be reserved for a very, very big shas al-chak situations. And I mean shas al-chak, it's on a Friday night and the woman, the mikveh is in a very dangerous neighborhood, or the woman is not well, it's very difficult for her to walk. these kinds of scenarios, it should not be taken flippantly to think, well, I heard that my friend got a cooler to go mi b'yod yom, so then I could also go mi b'yod yom. This is not something that should be posked in this manner. It's case by case whether there's any grounds ever to permit, but there may be certain extenuating circumstances that would permit going to the mikvah mi b'yod yom of the seventh day. The reason being that min ha-Torah, the Shiva Nikiyim, are technically over mi b'yod yom, according to some invoking the principle miktas yom kakulo, not all that different from Avelus, that the seventh day is over in the morning as well. Something which is an absolutely out of the question is for a woman to ever to go to the mikvah the night of the seventh. Namely to say, well, so now it's already the seventh day, so I can go to the mikvah already the night of the seventh. So that, we assume halacha that is an isakaris. That's, it may not literally be an isakaris because it may need and zava and all kind of complicated halacha calculations, but that's absolutely out of the question. Somebody recently was telling me that they heard that somebody gave a psak that a woman is allowed to go to the mikvah. According to the Mekilim, she can go to the mikvah the night before. So I said, whoever gave the psak, that was, I don't know who the person was, but I said that was a psak and error. There was somewhere there was a miscommunication here that's out of bounds in terms of psak halacha. But mibaod yom, so again, depending on different factors, may be off a discussion, but again, even the discussion should only be under very, very unique circumstances. The Shulchan Aruch writes that tefillah b'zman mitzvah, but then the Shulchan Aruch is quick to point out that it doesn't mean exactly what it sounds like. Tefillah b'zman mitzvah doesn't mean that a woman has to absolutely go to the mikvah at the right night. What it means is we strongly encourage her to go to the mikvah at the right time, because if a woman is trying to become pregnant, so it's quite possible that very, very small window of opportunity may be missed. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world is that the opportunity for a woman to become pregnant is a very, very small window in terms of a monthly cycle. And if for whatever reason she decides not to go that night, she waits till the next night, so she may very well lose out the opportunity to become pregnant. If the woman is trying to become pregnant, then we absolutely will strongly encourage her to go to the mikvah at the right time. If she's not trying to become pregnant and she's on medication, she's on pills, again, in a halakhically justified manner, so then we have a little bit less of a concern of tefillah b'zman mitzvah, but it's still something that we strongly recommend for the purposes of ona and the purposes of shalom bayis. So we would also encourage the couple that the woman should go to the mikvah at the right time. But here we'll be a little bit more lenient if there are some real factors involved. It's very, very difficult. They're away, they're out of town, and to coordinate how to get to the mikvah is going to be a very, very difficult ordeal. So then, if as long as the husband is okay with it, and the wife's okay with it, and she's on birth control anyway, so then if the two parties want to be, in a sense, moichel on that right of going to the mikvah on time, so then the poskim are a little bit more lenient about that. But again, we shouldn't take that flippantly either. We shouldn't say, well, it's no big deal, no need to go to the mikvah. No, we strongly encourage the couple so that the woman should go to the mikvah at the right time, and for sure, if she's attempting to become pregnant. When we speak about a woman going to the mikvah, so one of the basic requirements is that not only, of course, must she go entirely, her entire body, under the mikvah, under the water. That's the reason why the Shulchan Aruch quotes that you have to have somebody watch her when she goes to the mikvah, because otherwise there's no way of knowing whether her hair went under the water. So, of course, we have a practice. We have a woman, an attendant in the mikvah, who watches her. Under very unique circumstances, if she can't get a mikvah lady to watch her, sometimes her flight came in at 2 in the morning and the mikvah basically told her, we can't provide someone for you, we'll open the mikvah, but you have to bring your own, in a sense, person. And if she absolutely can't find anybody else to do it, so the poskim will make it, the husband could actually, I guess we can call him the mikvah man, he could technically watch the tefillah as well. It's a whole discussion in the poskim how we permit that, because isn't that an issue of him looking at makomos ha-mechusos? So the basic answer is that, well, she's going to the mikvah right now, she's going to become muteris in a second, so we're not as concerned about that particular hachacha. But again, that's also really the out of the ordinary. It should be just highlighted also, if for whatever reason a woman is going to the mikvah at not normal hours, we have to really make sure that she's given the right instruction by the people who are running the mikvah as to how to do things properly. Sometimes you can have almost a disastrous situation where the woman comes to the mikvah and things weren't prepared properly, and there's nobody who knows what's going on, and the filters on the mikvah are running. When the filter is on, that throws, depending on how the filter is constructed, throws serious question into the kashrus of the mikvah at that time. So a woman should not take the attitude, well, I remember the combination from last time, so I'll come in at 2 o'clock in the morning and my husband and we'll be fine. So that may not be a great idea. The plugs in the mikvah may not be positioned properly, the filters may not be positioned properly, so it's not a good idea unless somebody has instructed them properly how to use the mikvah after hours. when a woman goes to the mikvah, so of course the halachas of chatzitza apply. She has to be careful that there's nothing, no separation, no nothing that would pose a halachic problem in terms of separating between her and her body and the mikvah water. It's a little bit beyond the scope right now to talk about every single case of chatzitza. Suffice it to say that if a person suspects there's going to be a chatzitza problem, that's something that should be brought to the attention of the Rav before she comes to the mikvah. Some of the very uncomfortable situations, we once had a deal with a woman who had a very complicated chatzitza shaila. At the end of the day, we told her she could not go, and she was very, very upset. She had apparently traveled very far, lived out of town, and come very, very far to the mikvah, and was very, very upset. Obviously, it wasn't the time for me to explain to her that she should have called us before, but if she would have called us before, that would have alleviated, wouldn't have solved the shaila, but it would have alleviated a lot of the time and energy that had been spent to try to get her to the mikveh beforehand. So again, any complicated, anything out of the ordinary should be brought to a Rav's attention beforehand. Some of the common shailas that do come up in terms of things that one should be aware of, if a woman has had any dental work recently, so very often temporary fillings and stitches and things of that nature, there may be grounds to be mekel. There may be very real grounds to be mekel in a lot of these shailas, but they're things that should be discussed because the nuances are going to change. Sometimes stitches may be a problem, sometimes stitches may not be a problem. So again, each case has to be evaluated on its own merits. Anything more complicated than that, casts and things of that nature for sure, have to be discussed with the Rav beforehand. Again, so we did. One thing I could say is that we definitely did not learn all of Chasnid in the last 45 minutes, but I hope that we tried at least to familiarize ourselves a little bit with Chazara to know what some of the Rashi Prachim are, some of the since hot topics in Chasnid today, and some of the things that have to be brought to a Rav in order to give us the proper guidance as to how to observe these halachas properly.
We're going to have a Marav Minyan for anyone who has gotten Marav yet.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Silvestri. Thank you.